He was talking through his clenched teeth, a rehearsed answer. They had worked it out between them, I realized in dawning outrage. Then the Falcon added, "And you in turn must realize, Sarkin, that Prince Marek cannot possibly let you just keep Queen Hannah and your peasant girl here." He gestured to Kasha, standing beside me. "Of course, they must both go to the capital at once and face their trial for corruption." "A clever piece of maneuvering," the dragon said to me afterwards, "and an effective one. He is right. I don't have the right to abandon the valley without the king's leave. And by the law, strictly speaking, they must both stand trial." "But it doesn't have to be this instant," I said. I darted a look at the queen, sitting listless and silent in the wagon while the villagers piled too many supplies and blankets in around her. More than we would have needed if we'd been going to the capital and back again 3 times without a stop. "What if we just took her back to the tower now, her and Kasha? Surely the king would understand." The dragon snorted. "The king's a reasonable man. He wouldn't have minded in the least if I'd discreetly whisked away the queen for convalescence out of anyone's sight, before anyone had seen her or even knew for certain that she was rescued. But now..." He waved an arm at the villagers. Everyone had gathered in the loose ring near the wagon, at a safe distance, to stare at the queen and whisper bits of the story to each other. "No, he would object greatly to my openly defying the law of the realm before witnesses." Then he looked at me and said, "And I can't go either. The king might allow it, but not the wood." I stared back at him, hollow. "I can't let them just take Kasha," I said, half a plea. I knew this was where I belonged, where I was needed. But to let them drag Kasha off to the capital for this trial, where the law said they might put her to death, and I didn't trust Prince Marek at all, except to do whatever suited him best. "I know," the dragon said. "It's just as well. We can't strike another blow against the wood without soldiers, and the great number of them. And you are going to have to get them from the king. Whatever he says, Marek isn't thinking of anything but the queen, and Sole may not be wicked, but he likes to be too clever for everyone's good." I said finally a question. "Sole?" The name felt strange on my tongue, moving like the high shadow of a bird, circling. Even as I said it, I felt the brush of a piercing eye. "It means falcon in the spell tongue," the dragon said. "They'll put a name on you too, before you're confirmed to the list of wizards. Don't let them put that off until after the trial. Otherwise, you won't have the right to testify. And listen to me. What you've done here carries power with it, of a different sort. Don't let Solia take all the credit. And don't be shy of using it." I had no idea how to carry out any of the instructions he was firing at me. How was I supposed to persuade the king to give us any soldiers? But Marek was already calling for Tomasz and Oleg to mount up, and I didn't need the dragon to tell me I was going to have to work it out for myself. I swallowed and nodded instead, and then I said, "Thank you, Sarkin." His name tasted of fire and wings, of curling smoke, of subtlety and strength, and the rasping whisper of scales. He eyed me and said stiffly, "Don't land yourself into a boiling pot, and as difficult as you may find it, try and present a respectable appearance." Chapter 17. I didn't do very well at following his advice. We were a week and a day riding to the capital, and my horse jerked her head the entire way. Step, 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 and a sudden nervous thrust forward against the bit, pulling my reins and my arms forward, until my neck and my shoulders were hard as stone. I always lagged to the back of our little caravan, and the big iron-bound wagon wheels kicked up a fine cloud of dust in front of me. My horse added regular sneezing pauses to her gait. Even before we passed Alshanka, I was coated in pale gray, sweat clumping the dust into thick brown lines under my fingernails. The dragon had written me a letter for the king in the last few minutes we'd had together. It was only a few lines, hastily scribbled on cheap paper with thin ink borrowed from the villagers, telling him I was a witch and asking him for men. But he had folded it over and cut his thumb with a knife and wiped a little blood across the edge and then had written his name through the smear, Sarkhan, in strong black letters that smoked at the edges. When I took it out of my skirt pocket and touched the letters with my fingers, the whisper of smoke and beating wings came near. It was a comfort and a frustration at the same time, as every day's miles took me farther from where I should have been, helping to hold back the wood. "Why are you insisting on taking Kasia?" I said to Marek one last try as we camped the first night at the foot of the mountains, near the shallow eddy of a stream, hurrying off to join the spindle. I could see the dragon's tower to the south, lit orange by the last of the sunset. "Take the queen if you insist on it, and let us go back. You've seen the wood, you've seen what it is." "My father sent me here to deal with Sarkhan's corrupted village girl," he said. He was sluicing his head and neck down with water. "He is expecting her or her head. Which would you prefer I took with me?" "But he'll understand about Kasia once he sees the queen," I said. Marek shook off the water and raised his head. The queen still sat blank and unmoving in the wagon, staring ahead as the night closed around her. Kasia was sitting next to her. They were both changed, both strange and straight, and unwearied, even by a full day of travel. They both shone like polished wood. But Kasia's head was turned back looking towards Alshanka and the valley, and her mouth and her eyes were worried and alive. We looked at them together, and then Marek stood up. "The queen's fate is hers," he said to me flatly, and walked away. I hit at the water in frustration. Then I cupped water and washed my face, rivulets black with dirt running away over my fingers. "How dreadful for you," the falcon said, popping up behind me without warning and making me come spluttering up out of my hands. "To be escorted to Kralia by the prince, acclaimed as a witch and a heroine. What misery." I wiped my face on my skirt. "Why do you even want me there? There are other wizards at court. They can see the queen isn't corrupted for themselves." Solya was shaking his head as if he pitied me, silly village girl who didn't understand anything. "Do you really think it's so trivial? The law is absolute. The corrupted must die by the flame." "But the king will pardon her," I said. It came out a question. Solya looked thoughtfully over at the queen, almost invisible now, a shadow among shadows, and didn't answer. He glanced back at me. "Sleep well, Agnieszka," he said. "We have a long road yet to go." He went to join Marek by the fire. After that, I didn't sleep well at all, that night or any of the others. Word raced ahead of us. When we passed through villages and towns, people stopped work to line the road and stare at us wide-eyed. But they didn't come near and held their children back against them. And on the last day, a crowd was waiting for us at the last crossroads before the king's great city. I had forgotten hours and days by then. My arms ached, my back ached, my legs ached. My head ached worst of all. Some part of me tethered back to the valley, stretched out of recognizable shape, and trying to make sense of myself when I was so far from anything I knew. Even the mountains, my constants, had disappeared. Of course, I'd known there were parts of the country with no mountains, but I'd imagined I would still see them somewhere in the distance, like the moon. But every time I looked behind me, they were smaller and smaller, until finally they disappeared with one final gasp of rolling hills. Wide, rich fields, planted with grain, seemed to go on forever, in every direction. Flat and unbroken, the whole shape of the world gone strange. There were no forests here. We climbed one last hill, and at the summit, found ourselves overlooking the vast sprawl of Kralja, the capital. Yellow-walled houses with orange-brown roofs blooming like wildflowers around the banks of the wide shining Vandalus, and in the midst of them, Zamek Orla, the red brick castle of the kings, rearing up on a high outcropping of stone. It was larger than any building I could have imagined. The dragon's tower was smaller than the smallest tower of the castle, and there seemed to be a dozen of them, jutting up to the sky. The falcon looked around at me, I think to see how I took the view, but it was so large and strange that I didn't even gawk. I felt I was looking at the picture in the book, not something real, and I was so tired that I was nothing but my body. The steady, dull throb in my thighs, the tremor all along my arms, the thick grime of dust muffling my skin. A company of soldiers waited for us below at the crossroads, arrayed in ranks around a large platform that had been raised over the center. Half a dozen priests and monks stood upon it, flanking a man in the most astonishing priest's robes I had ever seen, deep purple, embroidered all over with gold. His face was long and severe, made longer by his tall, double-coned head. Marek pulled up, looking down at them, and I had time to catch my plodding horse up to him and the falcon. "Well, my father's trotted out the old Prosy," Marek said. "He'll put the relics on her. Is this going to cause difficulties?" "I wouldn't imagine so," the falcon said. "Our dear archbishop can be a little tedious, I'll grant you, but his stiff neck is all to the good at the moment. He'd never permit anyone to substitute in a false relic, and the real ones won't show anything that's not there." Caught in indignation at their impiety, calling the archbishop old Prosy, I missed the chance to ask for an explanation. Why would anyone want to show corruption if it wasn't there? Marek was already spurring his horse onward. The queen's wagon rattled down the hill behind him, and even though their faces were avid and bright with curiosity, the crowd of onlookers drew back from it like a wave washing back out from the shore, keeping well clear of the wheels. I saw many of them wearing cheap little charms against evil and crossing themselves as we passed. The queen sat without looking to either side or fidgeting, only rocking back and forth with the wagon's roll. Kasha had drawn close to her side, darting a look back at me that I returned, equally wide-eyed. We'd never seen so many people in our life. People were pressing in close enough around me to brush against my legs, despite my horse's big iron-shod hooves. When we drew up to the platform, the soldiers led us through their ranks and then circled around, leveling their pikes at us. I realized in alarm that there was a tall, thick stake raised up in the middle of the platform, and beneath it, a heap of straw and tinder. I reached forward and caught a corner of the falcon's sleeve in alarm. "Stop looking like a frightened rabbit! Sit up straight and smile!" he hissed at me. "The last thing we need to do right now is give them any excuse to imagine something's wrong. Marek behaved as though he didn't even see the sharp steel point not 2 feet from his head. He dismounted with a flourish of the cape he'd bought a few towns back and went to lift the queen down from the wagon. Kasia had to help her along from the other side, and then at Marek's impatient beckoning, she climbed down after her. I'd never known it before, but a crowd so large had a steady running noise to it, like a river, a murmuring that rose and ebbed without turning into separate voices. But now a complete hush descended. Marek led the queen up the steps onto the platform, the golden yoke still on her, and drew her before the priest in the tall hat. "My lord archbishop," Marek said, his voice rolling out clear and loud. "At great peril, my companions and I have freed the queen of Polnia from the evil grasp of the wood. I charge you now to examine her to the utmost, to prove her with all your relics and the power of your great office. Be sure that she bears no sign of corruption, which might spread and infect other innocent souls." Of course, that was exactly what the archbishop was here for, but I don't think he liked Marek making it seem as though it was all his idea. His mouth pressed down to a thin line. "Be sure that I will, Your Highness," he said coldly, and turned and beckoned. One of the monks stepped up beside him, a short, anxious-looking man in plain brown linen, with brown hair, cut in a round cap around his head. His eyes were enormous and blinking behind large gold-rimmed spectacles. He held a long, wooden casket in his hands. He opened it, and the archbishop reached in and lifted out with both hands a fine, shining mesh of gold and silver, almost like a net. The whole crowd murmured approvingly, wind rustling in spring leaves. The archbishop held up the net and prayed long and sonorously, and then he turned and flung the net over the queen's head. It settled over her gently, and the aegis unrolled, draping to her feet. Then, to my surprise, the monk stepped forward and put his hands on the mesh and spoke. "Illustus Cosmet, Illustus Cosmet, Vestua Palta," he began, and went on from there, a spell that flowed into the lines of the net and lit them up. The light filled the queen's whole body from every side, illuminating her. She shone atop the platform, head up straight, blazing. It wasn't like the light of the summoning. That was a cold, clear brilliance, hard and painful. This light felt like coming back home late in midwinter to find a lamp shining out of the window, beckoning you into the house. It was a light full of love and warmth. A sighing went around the crowd. Even the priests drew back for a moment just to look at the shining queen. The monk kept his hand on the net, steadily pouring in magic. I kicked my horse until she gradually moved in closer to the falcons and leaned from my saddle to whisper, "Who is he?" "Do you mean our gentle owl?" he said. "Father Balo. He is the archbishop's delight, as you might imagine. It's not often you can find a meek and biddable wizard." He sounded disdainful, but the monk didn't look so very meek to me. He looked worried and displeased. "And that net?" I asked. "You've heard of Saint Jadwiga's veil, surely," the falcon said. So offhanded, I gawked at him. It was the holiest relic of all Polnia. I had heard the veil was only brought out when they crowned the kings, to prove them free of any influence of evil. The crowd was jostling the soldiers now to come nearer. And even the soldiers were fascinated, the tips of their pikes rising into the air as they let themselves be pushed up close. The priests were going over the queen inch by inch, bending down to squint at her toes, holding each arm out to inspect her fingers, staring at her hair. But we could all see her shining, full of light. There was no shadow in her. One after another, the priests stood up and shook their heads to the archbishop. Even the severity in his face was softening, the wonder of the light in his face. When they had finished their examination, Father Balo gently lifted the veil away. The priests brought other relics too, and now I recognized them. The plate of St. Casimir's armor, still pierced with a tooth from the dragon of Kralja that he had slain. The arm bone of St. Fearon in a gold and glass casket, blackened from fire. The golden cup St. Jacek had saved from the chapel. Marek lifted the queen's hands unto each, one after another, and the archbishop prayed over her. They repeated each trial on Kasia, but the crowd wasn't interested in her. Everyone hushed to watch the queen, but they all talked noisily while the priests examined Kasia, more unruly than any crowd I'd ever seen, even though they were in the presence of so many holy relics and the archbishop himself. "Little more to be expected from the Kralja mob," Solya told my half-shocked expression. There were even bun sellers going around the crowd hawking fresh rolls, and from atop my horse I could see a couple of enterprising men had set up a stand to sell beer just down the road. It was beginning to have the feeling of a holiday, of a festival. And finally, the priests filled St. Jacek's golden cup with wine, and Father Balo murmured over it. A faint curl of smoke rose up from the wine, and it went clear. The queen drank it all when they put it to her lips, and she didn't fall down in a fit. She didn't change her expression at all. But that didn't matter. Someone in the crowd raised up a cup of slushing beer and shouted, "God be praised! The queen is saved!" People all began to cheer madly and press in on us, all fear forgotten, so loudly I could barely hear the archbishop giving his grudging permission for Marek to take the queen into the city. The crowd's ecstasy was almost worse than the soldiers' pikes had been. Marek had to shove people out of the way to get the wagon up next to the platform and lift the queen and Kasia back into it bodily. He abandoned his own horse and jumped into the cart and took the reins. He liberally lashed people away from the heads of the horses with the carter's whip to make room, and Solya and I had to bring our horses right up to the back of the wagon as the mob closed in again behind us. They stayed with us all the 5 miles left towards the city, running alongside and after us, and when any fell off the pace, more came to swell the ranks. By the time we reached the bridge over the Vandalus, grown men and women had abandoned their day's work to follow, and by the time we reached the outer gates of the castle, we were barely moving through a wildly cheering crowd that pressed in on us from all sides, a living thing with 10,000 voices, all of them shouting with joy. The news had traveled already. The queen was saved, the queen was uncorrupted. Prince Marek had saved the queen at last. We were all living in the song. That was how it felt. I felt it myself, even with the queen's golden head swaying back and forth with the rocking wagon and making no effort to resist the motion, even knowing how small our real victory had been and how many men had died for it. There were children running beside my horse, laughing up at me, and probably not in any complimentary way, because I was one enormous smudge with tangled hair and a torn skirt, but I didn't mind. I looked down and laughed with them too, forgetting my stiff arms and my numb legs. Marek rode at our head with a nearly exalted expression. I suppose it must have felt to him too, like his life had become a song. Right then, nobody was thinking about the man who hadn't come back. Oleg had the stump of his arm still bound up tightly, but he waved the other to the crowd with vigor and kissed his hand to every pretty girl in sight. Even when we had gone through the gates of the castle, the crowd didn't abate. The king's soldiers had come out of their barracks and the noblemen out of their houses, throwing flowers in our path, and the soldiers clashing their swords on their shields in a clamoring applause. Only the queen paid no attention to it all. They had taken the yoke and chains off her, but she said no differently. Still, next thing to a carven figure. We had to fall into single file to come through the final archway into the inner courtyard of the castle itself. The castle was dizzyingly large, arches rising in three tiers from the ground around me, endless faces leaning over the balconies, smiling down at us. I stared dazzled back up at them, at the embroidered banners in their riot of color everywhere, at the columns and the towers all around. The king himself was standing at the head of a staircase at one side of the courtyard. He wore a mantle of blue, clasped at the throat with a great jewel, a red stone in gold with pearls. The dull roar of cheering was still coming from outside the walls. Inside, the whole court hushed around us like the start of a play. Prince Marek had lifted the queen down from the wagon. He led her forward and up the stairs, courtiers ebbing like a tide before him, and brought her to the king. I found I was holding my own breath. "Your Majesty," Marek said, "I restore to you your queen." The sun was shining brilliantly, and he looked like a warrior saint in his armor and his green cloak, his white tabard. The queen beside him was a tall, stiff figure in her plain white shift, her short cloud of golden hair, and her transmuted skin lustrous. The king looked down at them, his brow drawn. He seemed more worried than jubilant. We were all silent, waiting. At last, he drew breath to speak, and only then the queen stirred. She slowly lifted up her head to look at him in the face. He stared at her. She blinked her eyes once, and then she sighed a little and sank in on herself as limply as a sack. Prince Marek had to drag her forward by the arm he held and catch her, or she would have fallen down the stairs. The king let out his breath, and his shoulders straightened a little, as if let off a string, relaxing. His voice carried strongly across the courtyard. "Take her to the Grey Rooms, and let the willow be sent for." Servants were already swooping in. They carried her away from us and into the castle, as if on a wave. And just like that, the play was ended. The noise inside the courtyard climbed back up to a roar to match the crowd outside, everyone talking to everyone else, across all three stories of the courtyard. The bright, heady feeling ran out of me, like I'd been unstoppered and turned over. Too late I remembered I wasn't here for a triumph. Kasia sat in the wagon in her white prisoner shift alone, condemned. Sarkon was 100 leagues away, trying to hold the wood off from Zatochik without me, and I had no idea how I was going to fix either of those things. I shook my feet out of my stirrups, heaved my leg over, and slithered to the ground inelegantly. My legs wobbled when I put my weight on them. A groom came for my horse. I let him take her away, a little reluctantly. She wasn't a good horse, but she was a familiar rock in this ocean of strangeness. Prince Marek and the falcon were going into the castle along with the king. I had already lost sight of Tomáš and Oleg in the crowd, surrounded by others in uniform. Kasia was climbing out of the back of the wagon, a small company of guards waiting for her. I pushed through the tide of servants and courtiers and got between them and her. "What are you going to do with her?" I demanded, shrill with worry. I must have looked absurd to them in my dusty, ragged peasant clothes, like a sparrow popping at the pack of hunting tomcats. They couldn't see the magic in my belly, ready to come roaring out of me. But however insignificant I looked, I was still part of the triumph of the queen's rescue, and anyway, they weren't inclined to cruelty. The chief guard, a man with the most enormous mustaches I had ever seen, the tips waxed into stiff curls, said to me kindly enough,
"Are you her maid? Don't fret. We are to take her to be with the queen herself, in the Grey Tower, with the Willow to look after them. Everything's to be done right, and by the law."
That wasn't much comfort. By the law, Kasia and the queen should both have been put to death at once. But Kasia whispered, "It's all right, Nyeshka." It wasn't. But there wasn't anything else to do. The guards put her among them, four men before and four men after, and marched her away into the palace. I stared after them hollowly for a moment, and then I realized I'd never find her again in this enormous place if I didn't see where they took her. I jumped and darted after them.
"Here now," a door guard said to me as I tried to follow them inside,
but I told him, "Param, param," humming it like the song about the tiny fly that no one could catch, and he blinked and I was past him. I trailed after the guards like a dangling thread, keeping my hum going to tell everyone I passed that I was too small to notice, nothing important. It wasn't hard. I felt as small and insignificant as could be imagined. The corridor went on and on. There were doors everywhere, heavy wood and hung with iron. Servants and courtiers bustled in and out of enormous rooms, hung with tapestries full of carven furniture and stone fireplaces bigger than my front door. Glittering lamps full of magic hung from the ceilings, and in the hallways, racks of tall white candles stood, burning without melting. Finally, the corridor ended in a small iron door, guarded again. The guards nodded to Kasia's escort and led them and ragtag me through into a narrow circling stairway, their eyes sliding over me. We climbed and climbed, my tired legs struggling to push me up each step, until at last we came crowding onto a small round landing. It was dim and smoky. There wasn't any window, and only an ordinary oil lamp stood set in a rough niche in the wall. It shone on the dull gray of another heavy iron door, a big round knocker upon it, shaped like the head of a hungry imp, the knocker's ring held in its wide open mouth. A strange chill came off the iron, a cold wind lapping at my skin. Even though I was pressed up against the wall in the corner behind the tall guards, the chief guard knocked, and the door swung inward.
"We've brought the other girl, my lady," he said.
"All right," a woman's voice said crisply. The guards parted to let Kasia through. A tall, slim woman stood in the doorway, yellow coiled braids and a golden headdress atop her head, wearing a blue silk gown delicately jeweled at the neck and waist, with a train sweeping the floor behind her. Although her sleeves were practical, laced snug from the elbow to the wrist. She stood to one side and waved Kasia in, past her, with two impatient flicks of her long hand. I had a brief glimpse of a large room beyond, carpeted and comfortable, and the queen sitting upright in a straight-backed chair. She was looking blankly out a window, down at the glitter of the Vandalus.
And what's this? The lady said, turning to look at me. All the guards turned and stared, seeing me. I froze. The chief guard stammered, going a little red in the face, with a darted look at the two men who'd been last in their party, a look that promised them trouble for not noticing me.
I'm Agnieszka, I said. I came with Kasia and the queen.
The lady gave me one incredulous stare that saw every snagged thread and every mud spatter on my skirts, even the ones in back, and was astonished to find that I had the gall to speak. She looked at the guard.
Is this one suspected of corruption as well? She demanded.
No, my lady, not as I know, he said.
Then why are you bringing her to me? I've enough to do here.
She turned back into the room, her train swashing along after her, and the door slammed shut. Another cold wave washed over me and back to the imp with its greedy mouth, licking away the last of my concealing spell. It devoured magic, I realized. That must have been why they brought corrupted prisoners here.
How did you get in here?
The chief guard demanded suspiciously, all of them looming around me. I would have liked to hide myself away again, but I couldn't with that hungry mouth waiting.
I'm a witch, I said.
They looked even more suspicious. I brought out the letter I still clutched in my skirt pocket. The paper was more than a little grabbier for wear, but the charred letters of the seal still smoked faintly.
The dragon gave me a letter for the king.
Chapter 18. They took me downstairs and put me into a small unused stateroom, for lack of any place better. The guards kept watch outside the door, while their captain went off, my letter in hand, to find out what ought to be done with me. My legs were ready to give out on me, but there was nothing to sit on but a few alarming chairs pushed up against the wall. Delicate, fragile-looking confections of white paint and gilt, and red velvet cushions. I would have thought any one of them a throne, if there hadn't been four in a row. I leaned against the wall for a while instead, and then I tried sitting on the hearth, but the fire hadn't been lit in here for a long time. The ashes were dead, and the stone was cold. I went back to the wall. I went back to the hearth. Finally, I decided that no one could put a chair in the room and not mean anyone to sit on it, and I gingerly perched on the edge of one of the chairs, holding my skirts close against me. The moment I sat, the door opened and a servant came in, a woman in a crisp black dress, something like Danka's age, with a small pursed mouth of disapproval. I sprang up guiltily. Four long gleaming red threads followed me unraveling from the cushion, caught on a burr on my skirt, and a long, sharp, white-painted splinter snagged in my sleeve and broke off. The woman's mouth pursed harder, but she only said, "This way, please," stiffly. She let me out past the guards, who didn't look sorry to see the back of me, and took me back up yet another different staircase. I'd seen half a dozen in the castle already, and showed me to a tiny dark cell of a room on the second floor. It had a narrow window that looked out on the stone wall of the cathedral. A rain spout, shaped like a wide-mouthed and hungry gargoyle, sneered in at me. She left me there before I could think to ask her what to do next. I sat down on the cot. I must have slept, because by the next thought I had, I was flat on the cot instead, but it wasn't a deliberate choice. I didn't even remember lying down. I struggled up, still sore and weary, but too conscious that I had no time to waste, and no idea what to do. I didn't know how to make anyone pay attention to me, unless I went to the middle of the courtyard and began to lob fire spells at the walls.
I doubted that would make the king any more inclined to let me speak at Kasha's trial. I was sorry now that I'd given the dragon's letter away, my only tool and talisman. How did I know it had even been delivered? I decided to go find it. I remembered the guard captain's face, or at least his mustache. There couldn't be many mustaches like that, even in all Kralia. I stood up and pulled the door open boldly, walked out into the hallway, and nearly ran straight into the falcon. He was just raising his hand to the latch on my door. He flowed deftly back out of my way, saving us both, and gave me a small gentle smile that I didn't trust at all. "I hope you're feeling refreshed," he said, and offered me his arm. I didn't take it. "What do you want?" He turned the gesture neatly into a long, inviting sweep of his hand towards the hallway. "To escort you to the Charovnikov. The king has given orders you're to be examined for the least." I was so relieved that I didn't quite believe him. I eyed him sidelong, half expecting a trick, but he kept standing there, with his arm and smile, waiting for me. "At once," he added, "although perhaps you'd care to change first." I would have liked to tell him what to do with his mocking little hint, but I looked down at myself, all mud and dust and sweat-stained creases, and underneath the mess, a homespun skirt that stopped just below my knee, and the faded brown cotton shift, worn old clothes I'd begged off a girl in Zatochik. I didn't look like one of the servants. The servants were far better dressed than me. Meanwhile, Solia had exchanged his black riding clothes for a long robe of black silk with a long sleeveless coat embroidered in green and silver over it, and his white hair spilled over it in a graceful fall. If you had seen him from a mile away, you would have known him for a wizard. And if they didn't think me a wizard, they wouldn't let me testify. "Try and present a respectable appearance," Sarkon had said. Vanastalem gave me clothes to match the mood of my sullen muttering. A stiff and uncomfortable gown of rich red silk, endless flounces edged in flame orange ribbons. I could have used an arm to lean on at that, trying to negotiate stairs and the enormous skirt without being able to see my feet, but I grimly ignored Solia's subtly renewed offer at the head of the staircase and picked my way slowly down, feeling for the edges of the steps with my tight slippered toes. He clasped his hands behind his back instead and paced me. He remarked idly, "The examinations are often challenging, of course. I suppose Sarkon prepared you for them." He threw me a mildly inquiring glance. I didn't answer him, but I couldn't quite keep myself from dragging my bottom lip through my teeth. "Well," he said, "if you do find them difficult, we might provide a joint demonstration to the examiners. I'm sure they would find that reassuring." I only glared at him and didn't answer. Anything we did, I was sure he'd take the credit for. He didn't press the matter, smiling on as though he hadn't even noticed my cold looks, a circling bird high above, waiting for any opening. He took me through an archway flanked by two tall young guards who looked at me curiously and into the Charovnikov, the Hall of Wizards. I slowed involuntarily, coming into the cavernous room. The ceiling was like an opening into heaven, painted clouds spilling over a blue sky, and angels and saints stretched across it. Enormous windows poured in the afternoon sunlight. I stared up, dazzled, and almost ran myself into a table, reaching blindly to catch myself with my hands on the corner and feeling my way around it. All the walls were covered in books, and a narrow balcony ran the full length of the room, making an even taller second level of bookcases. Ladders hung down from the ceiling on little wheels all along it. Great work tables stood along the length of the room, heavy solid oak with marble topping them.
This is only an exercise in delaying what we all know has to be done, a woman was saying, somewhere out of sight. Her voice was deep for a woman, a lovely warm sound. But there was an angry edge to her words.
No, don't start bleating at me again about the relics, Balo. Any spell can be defeated. Yes, even the one unholy blessed Jadwiga's shawl. And stop looking scandalized at me for saying so. Sola's gone drunk on politics to lend himself to this enterprise in the first place.
Come, Alyosha. Success excuses all risks, surely, the falcon said mildly as we rounded a corner and found three wizards gathered at a large round table in an alcove with a wide window letting in the afternoon sun. I squinted against it after the dim light of the palace hallways. The woman he'd called Alyosha was taller even than me, with ebony dark skin and shoulders as broad as my father's, her black hair braided tightly against her skull. She wore men's clothes, full red cotton trousers tucked into high leather boots, and a leather coat over it. The coat and the boots were beautiful, embossed with gold and silver in intricate patterns, but they still looked lived in. I envied them in my ridiculous dress.
Success, she said. Is that what you call this? Bringing a hollow shell back to the court just in time to burn her at the stake.
My hands clenched, but the falcon only smiled and said,
Perhaps we'd best defer these arguments for the moment. After all, we aren't here to judge the queen, are we? My dear, permit me to present to you Alyosha, our sword.
She looked at me, unsmiling and suspicious. The other two were men, one of them the same Father Balo who'd examined the queen. He didn't have a single line creasing his cheeks, and his hair was still solidly brown, but he somehow contrived to look old anyway, his spectacles sliding over a round nose in a round face as he peered up and down at me doubtfully.
Is this the apprentice?
The other man might have been his opposite, long and lean, in a rich wine-red waistcoat, embroidered elaborately in gold, and a bored expression. His narrow-pointed black beard curled up carefully at the tip. He was stretched in a chair, with his boots up on the table. There was a heap of short, stubby golden bars on the table beside him, and a small black velvet bag, heaped with tiny glittering red jewels. He was working two bars in his hands, magic whispering out of him. His lips were moving faintly. He was running the ends of the gold together, the bars thinning under his fingers into a narrow strip.
And this is Ragastok, the splendid, Soli said.
Ragastok said nothing and didn't even lift his head, save for one brief glance that took me in from head to feet and dismissed me at once and forever as beneath his notice. But I preferred his disinterest to the hard, suspicious line of Alyosha's mouth.
Where exactly did Sarkon find you? She demanded.
They'd heard some version of the rescue by then, it seemed, but Prince Marek and the Falcon hadn't bothered with the parts of the story that didn't suit them, and there was more they hadn't known. I stumbled through an awkward explanation of how I'd met Sarkon, uncomfortably aware of the Falcon's eyes on me, bright and attentive. I wanted to say as little as I could about Dvernik, about my family. He already had Kasha as a tool to use against me. I borrowed Kasha's secret fear and tried to hint that my family had chosen to offer me to the dragon. I made sure to say my father was a woodcutter, which I already knew they would disdain, and I didn't tell them any names. I said the village head woman and one of the herdsmen instead of Danka and Yerzi,
and made it sound as though Kasha was my only friend, and not just my dearest, before I haltingly told them of her rescue.
And I suppose you asked nicely, and the wood gave her back to you, said Ragastok without looking up from his work.
He was pressing the tiny red jewels into the gold with his thumbs, one after another.
The dragon, Sarkin, I found myself grateful for the small lift I felt from the thunder of his name on my tongue. He thought the wood gave her to me for the chance of setting a trap.
So he hadn't lost his mind entirely by then, Alyosha said. Why didn't he put her to death at once? He knows the law as well as anyone.
He let me try, I said. He let me try to purge her, and then it worked.
Or so you imagine, she said.
She shook her head.
And so does pity lead straight to disaster. Well, I'm surprised to hear it of Sarkin, but better men than he have lost their heads over a girl not half their age.
I didn't know what to say. I wanted to protest, to say, that's not it. There is nothing like that. But the word stuck in my throat.
And do you suppose that I lost my head over her as well? The falcon said in amused tones. And Prince Marek in the bargain.
She looked at him, an edge of contempt.
When Marek was boy of 8, he wept for a month, demanding his father take the army and every wizard in all Polnia into the wood to bring his mother back, she said. But he's not a child anymore. He should have known better, and so should you. How many men did this crusade of yours cost us? You took 30 veterans, cavalrymen, every one of them a prime soldier, every one of them carrying blades from my forge.
And we brought back your queen, the falcon said, a sudden hard bite in his voice.
If that means anything to you.
Ragastok heaved a noisy and pointed sigh without even looking up from his golden circlet. What difference does it make at the moment? The king wants the girl tried. So try her already, and let's be done with it. His tone made clear he didn't expect it to take long. Father Balo cleared his throat. He reached for a pen, dipped it into an inkwell, and leaned in towards me, peering through his small spectacles.
You do seem rather young to be examined. Tell me, my dear, how long have you been studying under your master?
Since the harvest, I said, and stared back at their incredulous eyes. Sarkin hadn't mentioned to me that wizards ordinarily took 7 years of study before asking to be admitted to the list. And after I spent a good 3 hours flubbing half the spells they set me on, exhausting myself in the meantime, even Father Balo was inclined to believe that Sarkin had gone stupidly in love with me, or was having some sort of joke at their expense to send me to be tested. The falcon was of no help. He watched their deliberations from the sideline with a mild air of interest, and when they asked him what magic he had seen me use, he only said,
I don't think I can properly attest. It's always difficult to separate the workings of an apprentice from a master, and Sarkin was there all the while, of course. I should prefer you all to make your own judgments.
And then he looked at me from under his lashes, a reminder of that hint he'd given me in the hallway. I gritted my teeth and tried again to appeal to Balo. He seemed the best chance for any sympathy, although even he was growing irritated.
Sir, I've told you, I'm no use at these kinds of spells.
These are not any kind of spell, he said, peevish and purse-mouthed. We have set you at everything from healing magic to inscription, under every element and every quarter of affinity. There is no category which encompasses all these spells.
But they're your sort of magic, not Yaga's, I said, seizing upon the example they would surely know.
Father Balo peered at me, even more dubiously.
Yaga? What on earth has Sarkhan been teaching you?
Yaga is a folk story.
I stared at him. Her deeds are borrowed from a handful of real wizards, mixed in with fanciful additions, and exaggerated over the years into mythic stature.
I gaped at him helplessly. He was the only one who had been polite to me at all, and now he was telling me with a straight face that Yaga wasn't real.
Well, this has been a waste of time, Ragastok said.
He hadn't any right to complain about that, though. He hadn't stopped working once, and by now his jeweled piece had become a tall circlet with a large socket in the middle, waiting for a larger gemstone. It hummed faintly with trapped sorcery. Pushing out a handful of cantrips isn't enough magic to make her worthy of the list. Now or ever. Alyosha had it right in the first place. What's happened to Sarkhan? He eyed me up and down. Without much excuse, but there is no accounting for taste.
I was mortified. And angry. And afraid even more than angry. For all I knew, the trial might start in the morning. I dragged in a breath against the hard, whalebone grip of the corsets, pushed back my chair and stood. And under my skirt, I stamped my foot on the ground and said,
Fulmia!
My heel came down jarring against a stone. A blow that rang through me and back out on a wave of magic. All around us, the castle shuddered like a sleeping giant, a tremor that made the hanging jewels on the lamp above our heads chime softly against one another, and brought books thumping down off the shelves. Ragastok had jerked up to his feet, his chair going over, his circlet cluttering out of his hands onto the table. Father Balo stared around at the corners of the room with startled blinking confusion, before he transferred his astonishment to me, as if surely there had to be some other explanation. I stood panting, with my hands clenched at my sides, still wringing head to foot, and said,
Is that magic enough to put me on the list? Or do you want to see more?
They stared at me. And in the silence, I heard shouts outside in the courtyard, running feet. The guards were looking in with their hands on their sword hilts, and I realized I'd just shaken the king's castle, in the king's city, and shouted at the highest wizards of the land. They did, after all, put me on the list. The king had demanded an explanation for the earthquake, and been told it was my fault. After that, they couldn't very well also say I wasn't much of a witch. But they weren't very happy about it. Ragastok seemed to have taken offense enough to build a grudge on, which I thought was unreasonable. He'd been the one insulting me. Alyosha regarded me with even more suspicion, as if she imagined I'd been hiding my power for some devious reason, and Father Balo just disliked having to admit me on the grounds of my being outside his experience. He wasn't unkind, but he had all Sarkhan's obsessive hunger for explanation, with none of his willingness to bend. If Balo couldn't find it in a book, that meant it couldn't be so, and if he found it in three books, that meant it was an unvarnished truth. Only the falcon smiled at me with that irritating air of secret amusement, and I could have done very well without his smiles. I had to face them in the library again the very next morning for the naming ceremony. With the four of them around me, I felt lonelier than in those early days in the dragon's tower, cut away from everything I'd known. It was worse than being alone, to feel that none of them were my friend, or even wished me anything good at all. If I'd been struck by a bolt of lightning, they would have been relieved.